மகியானதிமிரந்தஸ்யாக்ஞனஞ்சனாசலாகயாச்சாக்ஷுன்மீலிதம் யேன தஸ்மைஸ்ரீகுரவே நமஹ. வஞ்சாகல்பதரூபியஸ்ய கிருபாசிந்துப்யைவ ச ப்ரதீதானம் பவானேப்ய வைஷ்ணவேப்ய நமோ நமஹ. நடபிதச்சரிம் சீராத் கருணயாவதீர்ணா கலஹம் சமார்ப்பயிதமுன்னதஜ்வலராசம் சபக்தி ஸ்ரீயம் ஹாரிபுரதா சுந்தர தீர்த்தி கதம்ப சந்தீபிதா சதாரிதயே கந்தரேஸ்வரதோ வாசதி நந்தனா. வந்தே ஸ்ரீ கிருஷ்ண சைதன்ய நித்யானந்த சஹோதித குருதாய புஷ்பவந்த சித்ர சம்ருத்த மோனுதோ. ஹே கிருஷ்ண கருணா சிந்து தீனபந்தோ ஜகத்பதே கோபேஷா கோபிக கந்த ராத கந்த நமஸ்துதே. தப்த கஞ்சன கௌரங்கே ராதே பிருந்தவனேஸ்வரி விருஷபானுசுதி தேவி பிரணமாமி ஹரி பிரியே. பக்த்யா விஹீனாய அபராத லக்ஷாய க்ஷிப்தஸ்ராகமாதிதரங்கமாதி கிருபாமயித்வம் சரணம் ப்ரபானம் விருந்தே நமஸ்தே சரணாரவிந்தம் விருந்தே நமஸ்தே சரணாரவிந்தம். ஸ்ரீ சச்சிநந்தன் கௌர் ஹரி கீ ஜாய். ஸ்ரீ ஹரிநாம் சங்கீர்த்தன் கீ ஜாய். ஸ்ரீ ஸ்ரீ குணித்யநந்த கீ ஜாய். ஸ்ரீ கிருஷ்ண பலராம் கீ ஜாய். ஸ்ரீ ஸ்ரீ ராதகோபிநாத் கீ ஜாய். ஸ்ரீ ஸ்ரீ கௌதிய வைஷ்ணவ் குரு பரம்பரா கீ ஜாய். சாது சங்க கீ ஜாய். கௌர் பிரமானந்த. ஸோ தந்தபாத் ஆல்ஃபியூ. Thank you so much for being here and for somehow or other engaging me in an attempt of seva and harikatha all these days. That's why I keep traveling around the world begging for engagement in seva. So thank you for justifying my my pilgrimage. So today we will be talking about other of the main themes that we have been sharing these days. We have been talking about different avenues of possibilities, about vulnerability and about non-dual thinking, and about what to do with our humanity as spiritual practitioners, and how to interact with the world of matter in a healthy, balanced, sustainable way, and many other topics in between. Today, I was thinking tomorrow we will be opening the door for any questions that there may be on any topic. So today we'll be sharing one last of the main themes shared in my book, Radical Personalism. The idea is to talk about the guru-disciple relationship. So the title that came was like the light and shadow in the guru-disciple relationship. So ideally, of course, it should be all about light, but sometimes there is some shadow. Whenever there's light, there is some shadow. So how to integrate the shadow in Jungian terms, how to do shadow work. And yeah, all this corresponds with a chapter of the book. I think it's chapter 11. Yeah. Which I named Issues, Anti-issues Between Guru and Disciple. And as I say a few times, it was funny because when I say tissues, according to my acquaintance with English, for me, tissues refer to like layers, different tissues. But tissues is also this paper that we use to clean your tears, right? Napkins or something. So most people, when talking with them, they understood the second option, the one I didn't intend. So like it was all about tears and tragedy. I'm like, oh. And I was trying to say just issues and tissues, like layers in a relationship, like any relationship. But it was misleading. So I'm just apologizing if anyone here was scared or traumatized or very disturbed by the title. That was not my intention. So yeah, let's share a few thoughts about guru disciple, both, because whenever we speak about guru, we're speaking about disciple. There is no guru without disciple. There is no disciple without guru. We cannot talk about being a teacher without having students. You cannot talk about being a student without having a teacher. So it's like interdependent dynamics and relationship. And what's guru, what's disciple? These are sometimes, some of these topics are more complicated than what we think. No, it's not that I want to make things more complicated than what they are, but sometimes we oversimplify some things, and that in itself creates some complication, right? It's not that we want to complicate things, but some things are complicated. So when we want to make some we want to be very simplistic about complex things, that's in itself a complication that creates a problem. So guru tattva is complex, not complicated in a negative sense, but it's a complex tattva. In fact, many Gaudiya Vaishnava acharyas have said guru tattva is the most difficult tattva, or the most difficult truth to understand among all these tattvas: bhakti tattva, maya tattva, jiva tattva, whatever, so many tattvas, gaur tattva. Guru tattva is one of the most complicated ones, complex one to understand, which may, another way of putting it, will be guru tattva is one of the easiest ones to misunderstand. If it's one of the most difficult to understand, it may be very easy to misunderstand, to think that I understand it and I'm not understanding it. So, and why it's so difficult, again, I'm not trying to make it more difficult than what it is, but in which sense we could say guru tattva is complex. Well, as we were talking the other day, for example, with Dina Dayal in our walk and with other devotees throughout these days and years and decades, that many times when we speak about guru, we tend to think about one person. And we think that's guru. And that's guru, but that's not only that's guru. So then starts the complexity. The guru is, the individual agent appearing in a human form, teaching, giving example, and so on. That's guru, of course. But not only that's guru. We shouldn't be like reductionistic and boil down guru to whatever. A human figure teacher, or some even will say the Diksha guru, and then we have Siksha guru, but also beyond that, we have guru tattva as a principle, as a department. Jiva Goswami speaks about Vyasti and Samasti. Maybe you heard this expression. Vyasti guru is the individual the individual agent, and Samasti will be kind of the agency. It's the agency of guru and the agents that represent the agency. So Samasti is the universal guru principle. Vyasti is the localized individual guru agent. But all of them are guru. So what do I mean by the universal guru principle? Well, we can start just saying Krishna. Krishna is the universal guru. He's the first guru. If we want to, the parampara, it starts with God. So God is guru. The Bhagavatam, I try to count and compile a few, but there are so many times that Krishna is called Param Guru, Jagat Guru, Akhil Guru, the guru of everyone, the guru of the universe, the guru of all gurus. And there are many lines where God is established as guru. Chaitya Guru, we were talking the other day, God in the heart as a guru. And of course we say, and the human representative is ideally, like as Prabhupada will say, transparent, be a medium through which God's will comes to us. And that's perfect and beautiful and real. But not to the point of forgetting that God as an individual entity is also guru. And he can manifest his guruship or guruhood or guru-ness in so many directions, in so many ways. Like the Srimad Bhagavatam, as we know, the 11th canto will talk, as we said the other day, about 24 gurus. And in the 24 gurus, it starts with Mother Earth, first guru. And you are like, but she's not in the parampara. Did she give diksha to someone? Who is her guru? This type of like question. But it's considered guru. No? Then the sun, the moon, the wind, And so gradually you are taking to this notion that, okay, everywhere is guru. Everything is guru. the ultimate conclusion, Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, is to enter into a land of gurus, where everything is your guru. Mahaprabhu will look at the grass and say, Trinada Pistunichin, and say, wow, the grass is teaching me to be humble. And then he looks at the tree, many of these trees in Radha Desh. It was not a special magical tree he was looking at, which has something carved in it. Tarora Pistunichin. No. He saw the tree and no, he said, Tarora Pistunichin. So he saw a tree, he saw Guru. Wow, Guru Tattva is coming. Again, Krishna is Guru. Let me take it further. It may sound a little too much, but it's reality is too much. I was like one, there's one song that I like to hear in my early teens. Hopefully I'm not so old and you can know the author. George Harrison. Okay.
Who's that?
I went to something safe. No, everyone has to know this. So he had this song called It's All Too Much. No? I like the title. It's all too, in the good sense of the term, right? Because you can say, oh, this is too much. No? But you can say, wow, this is too much. So he will say, it's all too much. No? So many things we can say only on that line. But today's title is not It's All Too Much, so we'll go move forward. But what I will say, it's too much in the good sense of the term, because we say Krishna is the original guru. Okay, Samasti Guru, the universal principle of guru. And Krishna, technically speaking, he's everywhere. He's omnipresent. So if Krishna is omnipresent and Krishna is guru, what's it? If A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then... Where guru is not, is the conclusion. Of course, again, well, but who has the eyes to see that? Of course, that's for that we need one person that begins to instruct us about how guru is everywhere. And that's it, how guru parampara should work. No, we may have a guru, one more prominent guru, or more than one sometimes, diksha gurus, siksha gurus. And gradually our notion of guru starts to expand from my first one and only guru to, okay, and this other person inspires me so much. I feel that this person is guru. And this, because guru basically is an agency through which divine revelation comes to our life. God's will comes to our life. Technically speaking, we can call it guru. So eventually this portal starts to amplify to the point that where guru is not, right? But again, we have to begin somewhere. But we should at least bear in mind, we have to be careful not to be very reductionistic, no, with how we think about these topics. No, like the other day we were talking with Dina Dayal in our Bhagavad Gita path walk, that sometimes devotees will ask you, who is your guru? And I would say the question is wrongly formulated because the question is demanding a singular answer, an answer in singular. I have to give you one name. But again, according to what we are talking, of course, I'm not saying that if someone asks you that question, who is your guru, you can say everything. Some people say that, but some people say that as an excuse not to have to accept one person that actually teaches them how everything is guru. So I'm not proposing this. Whenever someone asks you that, you just say everything. That's fine. But also, again, who is your guru? How does Chaitanya Charitamrita begins? Which are the first two words of Chaitanya Charitamrita, which, according to Srila Prabhupada, is our postgraduate study of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, PhD. Bande Gurun. Vande Gurun. Gurun means guru in plural. So Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami sets the tone right at the beginning. See, I offer Bande Vandanam, I offer my Dandava, my Prana to my gurus. Like immediately put in the tone, there's a plurality of them. There's one Diksha Guru, but there can be a plurality of Siksha Gurus. So we have, it's important that we get accustomed to think about the things in plural. So that allows for eventually expanded that plurality to everything is good. Because if I'd set the tone with only one, only one, only one, only one, probably I will always see only one. And when someone tells me I have two gurus, just that may be a threat. No. And then you find a super self-realized person like in the Bhagavata, I have 24. And it's like, how can you have 20? Try to imagine in practice if someone asks you, who is your guru? I say, I cannot reply in singular, I have 24 gurus. And you may think, that's not bona fide. And just like, well, it comes right out of the Bhagavatam. And what to speak if then when they ask you, okay, give me the 24 names of the 24 gurus. Well, many of them do not have a name. One is earth, another is sun, and they said, no, you're a hippie, you're lost. That's in the Bhagavatam. No? Not using the Bhagavatam to justify anything, but also we have to be careful how one thing is reading something and say, oh, so nice. But then if that comes to test us in practice, we may like label that and stigmatize and demonize that. But it's like, what's the difference? Well, to speak in that list, one of the gurus that we said the other day is a prostitute. Bilba Mangala Thakur's one of main gurus is Chintamani, the prostitute. He even offered pranams to her at the beginning of Krishna Karnamrita. To his Diksha Guru, to his Siksha Guru, Krishna, and Diksha Guru Somagiri, and his somehow, I don't know how to call her, but unique guru, Chintamani. So imagine, he's offered pranam to a prostitute in the Mangala Charan of his most esoteric book, so to say. And we are praising that. Imagine someone asks you, who is your guru? A prostitute. It's like, you call emergency number immediately. So we have to see how to. And again, who is your guru? It's like if it's wrongly formulated because it's limiting the answer to a singular, to one name. It's like if I ask you, Purushottam, who is your friend? And you're like, why are you asking singular? Why are you limiting me to just have one friend? Right? Who's your friend? And it's like, why do I have to say one name? Why cannot I have two friends? Why cannot I have many friends? So guru in one sense is a friend, you could say. Guru is the well-wishing friend. So why we are so ungenerous in limiting the scope of how many friends we can have in terms of guru? And of course, from that line, all another misconceptions may come when sometimes we think, even in this dynamics of who is your guru answers, like, who is your guru? And I have to have a name, and when I give the name, I'm legal. Now, I'm stamped, I'm in. If I have my name, I have had my credential, I was initiated by that, I'm in. Nobody can tell me. Even if my relationship with my guru is disjointed, there's no connection, but I'm initiated. But you follow my point? So sometimes we may just that, give me the name and you're in. That's it. I don't care for whatever happens after. And sometimes we can be even not very personal to each other because you may tell me who is your guru and great, but then comes how the relationship, the work as a disciple, all those questions are very important. Not just get the name, get credential, a little the membership. It's okay. It's a step, but it's not just getting the credential. It's how to develop everything else, right? Or like who was talking to me, Ram Hari, the other day, one devotee thing in Croatia, that I think she saw a few unfortunate dynamics with Guru Tattva in decades, 40 years ago. She kind of decided, I won't take initiation in this lifetime or something. Interesting bow. But she has remained for 40 years, like almost the most dedicated devotee of the whole community. So it's like this particular situation, and like how to accommodate that. And we have to accommodate that somehow or other. And how much we can say that person, even if it's not initiated, how much that person is disconnected from the parampara or something like that, right? especially in our Bhakti no Parivar, is even like ironical, because many times when we ask this question, who is your guru, we are expecting that the name you give is your Diksha guru, generally. While in our tradition, we emphasize so much Siksha and the notion even of Siksha Parampara. But when I ask you, who is your guru, I want the Diksha guru. So it's like still contradictory. So we need to like solve some of those contradictions, because of all of them show again, we may not be grasping Guru Tattva in its entirety, and it's important. It's important. So that said, a few words on the relationship between guru and disciple, no? And the exchange and the nature of the exchange. Because we said again, guru is a universal principle. You ultimately guru is everywhere, but also to reach that level of vision and realization, we need connection with specific agents. So how that relationship works, what's the role, which is the light and shadow of those dynamics, so to say. So something that I personally like to emphasize is that we have space. Put this here in case someone wants to come here. Welcome. Okay, you need there, if not. Okay. Welcome. If someone prefers here, it's more comfortable also. So, fine. So, we're giving some introduction to the topic of today, which is light and shadow in the guru-disciple relationship, based on chapter 11 of Radical Personalism, and talking about a little bit that guru tattva is a complex subject, because we may think we understand it, but sometimes we are just restricting it too much to the individual agent, instead of also seeing the aspect that guru is a universal agency as well, starting with God himself, right? And ultimately, Krishna is original guru. And as we say, Krishna is everywhere, therefore the guru is everywhere. In principle, there's not a place where guru tattva is not. But in practice, we don't see that. So we may need one person to teach us that guru is of that level of universality. So go into that individual relationship, guru-disciple relationship. A few things that I personally think are important, at least for me, to have in mind. One is that the role of the guru is not so much like a position, because sometimes it may be seen as such, like a position to attain. And whenever I reach that position, I can enjoy some considerable benefits, so to say, or something like that. But guru is a service, basically. Even if you want to use the word position, it's fine. It's a position of a servant. No? To be a servant is also a position. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur says in Vaishnava ki Vaishnavera pratishta tate kurunishta. No, he speaks about pratishta, this word position. He says position is not a bad thing. Pratishta asha is the problem, like the desire to have a position, which is not the position of a servant. So he says Vaishnavera pratishta tati koranishta, try to fix yourself in entering in the position of a Vaishnava, of a servant of all. So guru is basically that. The role of a guru is that of a servant. It's a servant, and the role of the disciple is that of a servant. We are all talking about different forms of service. So the guru is serving the faith of the disciple, for example. The disciple has certain faith, and the role of the guru is to attend that faith, nourish that faith, kindle that fire. It's a service. It's in seva. Whatever needs to be done for nourishing that faith, genuine guru will be willing to do that. Sometimes, as I like to say also, the guru is a servant of the disciple's potential. because Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, and I like very much this definition, he will say the guru, again, always when I say guru, I'm talking about who is someone who is a genuine representative of that. The guru is your own potential appearing in front of you. I leave it a few seconds in silence for you to chew that idea. The guru is your own potential, all that you can be, appearing in front of you. It's another person who is showing through example and precept all that you can become in terms of the potential of the soul. So somehow your own potential appears embodied in front of you. So the guru is not only your potential appearing in front of you, but then someone who is a servant of your potential. So who is there willing to assist you so you can attain your potential? Because if I'm only your potential appearing in front of you without assisting you in achieving that potential, that can be overwhelming. Imagine if you are all day in front of someone who is showing you all that you can be. It can be like, I'm not assisting you to attain that, just showing you. This is all that you can be. It can be even a form of bullying. No, like, this is all that you can be, but still you are not. This is all that you can be. This is all that you can be, still you are not, but I am. And you have a constant reminder. It can be hell. But if that person is showing you that horizon and then being completely willing to assist you in achieving that, wow, that's like the perfect combination, so to say. So in that sense, I like to see the guru as like a servant and of the disciple's potential, a facilitator of potential. Let's put it that way. Today the word facilitator is used sometimes. He's facilitating this retreat. He's facilitating this presentation. The guru is a facilitator of potential. Welcome. Whenever you want, if it's more comfortable here, also whatever. Leaving this here so people know that they can sit there. It seems like it's really safe for someone. Also, something that I like always to make the point that I already briefly mentioned is that both guru and disciples are both disciples. Not only because the guru has his or her own guru, but also because both are servants of the same ideal, so to say. No? Both are servants of Krishna, both are servants of divine love. So in that sense, guru and disciple are working together on the same project, as I like to put it. It's like teamwork. No? It's not so much like you are on your own, I am on my own in a very different. No, we are all both trying to serve the same Supreme Person, trying to reach the same goal, trying to continue to reach that goal, because as we were talking the other day, even if you say a guru is in the highest platform and attain divine love, the nature of divine love is that you can always attain more divine love. So even if I'm in the platform of Prema Bhakti, which I'm not, just in case, don't create any false myth around me. But if hypothetically, if I'm there, the nature of Prema Bhakti is that I can always attain further Prema Bhakti. And there is no end to that. So in one sense, I attain the goal, but I can always continue to attain the goal. So in that sense, guru and disciple are the two of them in a joint exploration of going, excavation of further depths, no, of experience and service and love. So in that sense, it's teamwork. Again, I think it's very healthy to conceive the guru-disciple relationship as both working together in service of the same ideal. Not only guru-disciple, but ideally every genuine guru are also working together. It shouldn't be like a competition, not like this guru versus that guru and one trying to pull disciple here and the other pulling there. Ideally, we are all trying to pull the boat in the same direction because we have the same goal, Krishna Prem, right? So... So in that sense, I think it's important to, for the disciple and for the guru, for both, to think of the relationship, okay, it's like a contract, the two of us, it's like a marriage, if you will, you know, signing a contract, getting a commitment, And the two are teamwork. Now, wife, husband is you're working together for a project that is bigger than each of you separately. Not something like that. It's bigger than my own individual ego and all that I like. And I, oh, that's game over for that. There is someone else, and there is a commitment, ideally, that is beyond the two of you, which is beautiful in itself. I'm not describing that as something like inferior and dark well of family life. I'm not that type of sannyasis, you know already. I'm just saying about, yeah, properly established commitment is, it helps us to rise beyond our own individual stuff. But it's a teamwork. So in one sense, guru-disciple, although it's not a relation between equals in one sense, as it may happen between husband and wife, still is a form of teamwork. And from the place of the guru, from the side of the guru, there is also lots of, again, guru is also a disciple. Guru is also student. No? Student forever, we will say. No? The more advanced you are as a guru, the more capacity you have to learn. That's one of the symptoms of spiritual advancement. The more advanced you are, the more you can learn. It's not that I'm so advanced that I cannot learn anything from any of you. No. I'm so high that only you can learn from me. That's the opposite. The higher I am, the more I can learn from anyone and from everything. Again, Mahaprabhu just looking a blade of grass and composing our most important instructions just by learning from blade of grass, as we were talking today. A blade of grass is bending but not breaking. No. So he's saying, be humble like the blade of grass. Bend without breaking. Because sometimes that verse is used to bend and break. And become traumatized about how to be humble and more humble than the blade. But how the blade of grass is being humble? It's bending without breaking. It's flexible. And he got all those lessons just by looking at the quote-unquote insignificant blade of grass. What's the connection between the most significant Mahaprabhu and an insignificant blade of grass? Well, for Mahaprabhu, the blade of grass is not that insignificant. He's seeing Guru there. He's learning from everyone. So my point with this, and hopefully you get my idea, is of course the disciple is learning from the guru, and that's one of the main features of the guru-disciple relationship. The disciple comes to learn from the guru, to learn Shastra, to learn how to conduct yourself in bhakti, an example, learn so many things. Learn. But it doesn't mean that the guru is not learning anything from the disciple. Again, if the guru is more advanced than the disciple, as it should be, ideally. And if being more advanced means having more capacity to learn, then we could make the point that the guru is learning more from the disciple than the disciple from the guru. Follow my point? And it's beautiful in its own way. It doesn't mean that, oh, I'm instructing my guru there way more than he is instructing me. It has nothing to do with that. I'm nobody, but Sri Guru is such a person, ideal, that he or she, just in case, is able to extract wisdom from any direction. And you can tell me, well, Maharaj, but that sounds strange. That sounds like unusual. That sounds like a weird idea. Probably you are creating your own stuff. Where is that coming from? And I will reply, just look at the Bhagavatam. You need to go further than that. Look at the main, who is the main guru figure in the Bhagavatam in one sense? Sukadev Goswami. No? Parikshit Maharaj's disciple, Sukadev Goswami.
Better?
Yeah. There are different sessions of the Bhagavatam, of course, right? Different interactions. Well, we could say the main one is Parikshit Maharaj and Sukadev Goswami in one sense. So Parikshit, this is the disciple. Sukadev Goswami is the guru. But interestingly, when Sukadev Goswami is speaking the Bhagavatam to Parikshit, different people come to hear from him. And among them, who is there in the first line, so to say? Probably he also was there, but go to my point. My point is Sukadev Goswami speaking the Bhagavatam. Who is Sukadev Goswami's guru? Who talked the Bhagavatam to Sukadev Goswami? Yes. Yes. It was easier than what you imagine. And Vyasadeva is his father as well, and is his guru. So Vyasadeva is Sukadev Goswami's guru. He's there sitting hearing the Bhagavatam from Sukadev Goswami. No? So the father and guru is sitting hearing his son and disciple. And who is next to Vyasa? Narad Muni. Who is Narad Muni? Vyasadeva's guru. So Narad Muni is the guru of the speaker, right? And he's wrapped in attention, listening Bhagavatam. He's not saying, who is this boy, Sukadev? He's the disciple of my disciple. I should be given the class. No, I should be given Bhagavatam class. I'm the senior one here. What's this 16-year-old naked boy sitting on the Vyasasan? Nobody protested about that. Everyone was just, because they knew truth is being channeled here. No, the real current is descending, no matter in which vessel Guru Tattva is manifesting. So they were listening. Like one devotee once say, when wise men speak, wise men listen. Doesn't matter who is younger, older, when real revelation and wisdom is manifesting, if you are really wise, you will just like humbly open to that. No consideration of elder, younger, that's so gender, form, cloth, naked. I mean, Sukadev Goswami is a pretty much interesting example, right? Because, and that speaks about the quality of Parikshit Maharaj as a disciple. So because Parikshit Maharaj as a disciple, so we know he was the emperor of the whole world, lots of experience in life, so to say, elder relatively. He's looking for a guru, so you may expect that he will look for someone elder than him, with some experience similar to him. And suddenly he sees this 16-year-old naked boy, and he feels Jai Gurudev. Yeah. Which is counterintuitive for how we generally think in terms of, hey, who is my guru? It has to be older, it has to be man, it has to be Indian, it has to be long beard, big turban, singing nicely, know three languages, minimum 2,000 disciples, of course. I know each one has their, I'm not saying everyone, but each one has their own list of requirements. And someone like Sukadev Goswami suddenly enters the room and breaks all that to pieces, right? And Parikshit Maharaj is Saragrahi, essentialist enough to see beyond all the formalities and see that's guru coming. No, the surrender. So that's the main example of the Bhagavatam of guru and disciple. No? So we should take the lesson, no? Not only of the disciple being such essentialist, but also again the guru being such essentialist to the point that being willing to learn from her own students. Whenever that's the case, whenever that happens, and even if it doesn't happen, because you can say, well, but he was Sukadev Goswami, no? Who among us is Sukadev Goswami? I get the point, but even not being Sukadev Goswami doesn't mean that your guru cannot learn anything from you. No, even if you are a disaster and you are a mess up to top to head to toe, the guru in his, her mercy, ambition will always be drawing something, some insight. That's the nature of being enlightened. Everything is talking to you. Everything is guru. Everything is teaching. Again. So of course in... I think you already imagined that the nature of this relationship, as we are given this example, should be very, very sweet, very intimate, very beautiful. And that's why Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu says the relationship between guru and disciples should be Vishrambhena Guru Seva. One should offer service to the guru in Vishramba. Vishramba means like difficult to just say one word in English, but something like confidence or like intimate trust, like a type of friendship. Again, it's not that we are equals, but there is some intimacy and friendship, like at least at some point of the relationship. Like if you have a relationship with your father, and first his father, his dad, I'm the son, but eventually the relationship should evolve into some form of friendship. Still, he's my dad, but we are friends now. So ideally, guru-disciple relationship should also evolve in that direction. Which are the symptoms of a guru? I can share a few words about that. Of course, you may know them. And there's something very interesting, because every main verse in scripture which describes the symptoms of a guru also describes the symptom of a disciple. Because again, we cannot talk about one without the other. You cannot be a guru without disciples. You're going to be a disciple without a guru. You can. So in every one of these verses, which I will say there are mostly three, they are almost very similar, and all of them speak about guru and disciple, guru and disciple. So let's see, those who have taken Bhakti Shastri, let's take some little tests. I hope nobody's feeling nervous here.
I have papers here,
you have Bhakti answers.
Oh, okay. Now relax. No,
it's gone now. Our attention is back.
Yeah. So, of course, the famous verse of Bhagavad Gita about Guru and Disciple, fourth chapter, verse 34. I'm giving the hints. Thank you, Anupam.
Bravo.
Tadvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadikshanti teknyanam gyaninastattva darshana. Now we can go to Srimad Bhagavatam. Then there is a famous verse there that also is speaking about the symptoms of a guru, 11th canto, which says, Tasmat gurum prapadyata jignyasu sri autamam brahmani upashamashraya sabde parichanishnatam brahmani upashamashraya. And there's one more verse from it's Mundaka Upanishad, Tad vijnanartam sagurume vabhi gachet samit panishratriyam brahmanishtam. These three basically, I don't want to say the same, but in the spirit they say the same. They say on one side, the disciple, and most of them start describing the disciple, interestingly. That's what came to me one day, because during the year we have this one day called Guru Purnim, which is like the day of the guru once in a year. But we don't have like Shishya Purnim, the day of the disciple. Why? Because it's included in Guru Purnim. I mean, you cannot have one without the other. No? So you cannot celebrate gurus if there are no disciples. So we may call, I'll call from now on Guru Shishya Purnim. No, sometimes we say Guru Parampara, but the specific expression is Guru Shishya Parampara. Because there must be both. And again, Guru is a Shishya at the same time. So these verses describe first the disciple. No? And the disciple is described in terms of, for example, Jignyasu Shreya Uttamam, a very sincere inquiry into the highest possible good. That has to be kind of the spirit of the disciple, of a student. Students like, I'm studying the nature of reality. I'm passionate about it. What's the highest possible good? I reached this conclusion, but tomorrow I may reach another conclusion and another conclusion, not just in a rational way, but in an internal like journey of discovery. What's the highest possible good? What's the highest possible way of giving myself to that good? Surrender then. Pranipat, pariprasna, seva. Pariprasna means inquiry, honest inquiry. Pranipat means giving myself in that journey. Like I remember talking with Jai Jagannath Prabhu and we were making this play of words. We are set on a quest, and every quest imply some questions. No? So the questions set us on a quest, and when those questions are answered, sometimes we need a new set of questions to continue the quest on another level, and so on and so forth. So those are basically the duties of the disciple, to be very honest about his or her inquiry into the nature of truth, and to be willing to ask and to be willing to give myself to that journey and to be willing, of course, to reciprocate, give back all the gift that ideally one will receive from Guru in form of replies and example. Naturally, it should be a loving interaction. And the symptoms of the Guru mostly are, like in this verse, I'm not going verse by verse and saying in each verse the same thing is said. But the Guru is described as someone who knows the scriptures, who is conversant with Shastra, because disciples will have questions and answers will be also connected to the scriptures. It's not just that the Guru is like, well, according to my imagination, this is the answer. No. So there has to be some reference to revelation, and on that foundation, the idea is that the Guru is schooled on that. But the Guru also has some insight and realization of that knowledge. It's not just knowledge, but a practical realization of that. Bhagavad Gita will say, Gyaninas tattva darshinaha. So the Guru is Gyani, in the sense he has knowledge, she has knowledge, and tattva darshin, he's a seer of truth, which speaks more about realization. I'm knowing what I'm knowing. And also one interesting question, word that the Bhagavatam describes is upasamashrayam. This verse, it says upasamashrayam is the Guru has taken shelter, ashrayam, in upasama, in tranquility. Confirmed. That was their key jai. Yeah. they like that poem. It was a goal. It's a good one. We have somehow to integrate the environment. So the Guru has to have,
I mean, there is no coincidence. I mean, everything happens
God incidents. Yeah.
I heard louder.
So that the Guru's upasamashrayam, or he or she has taken shelter into tranquility, what does it mean? Well, it can be translated as the Guru has control his, her mind and senses. But also we could extend that to the idea, as I'll try to put it in my book, that also the Guru has to have a balanced humanity. It has to be on some level relatively wholesome and healed on a psychological and emotional level. Because if there are too many unresolved issues on a psychological, emotional level, the Guru's interaction, those issues will get in the way of the Guru's relationships, interaction, understanding of the disciples' own psycho-emotional dynamics, which are part of the spiritual journey. You cannot entirely separate them too. So the point is, you can have lots of knowledge, you can even have spiritual advancement, but at the same time, there can be some unaddressed human issues that sometimes get in the way of the relationship. And even they may end up creating abuse, even if there was no intention of creating abuse. That's an interesting point. No. In fact, there is lots of research that many, not all, but many of the most traumatic abuses, for some people at least, were done by good people who had unresolved human issues. Were not done by really bad intended personalities. They were just people indulging in abuse without them knowing that they were indulging in abuse because of their own unresolved issues. So I'm pointing this because unless these things, we become aware of the things, they are not seen for what they are. They can even become normalized.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
What in particular?
This last part, sometimes good intention can create impact.
My main point is that someone may have some particular unresolved human issue, unresolved trauma, some dysfunction. Let's give an example. Some person may not have a capacity of dealing with the vulnerability of other person. Like you come to me in full vulnerability, as we were talking the other day. But I'm not accustomed to deal with vulnerability. It's not that I'm a bad person. It's not that I want to harm you anything. It's just that I don't know what to do with that. And you come with your vulnerability as a student, and me as a teacher, I'm like not skilled in coexisting with other people's fragility and nakedness, inner nakedness and openness, and like, so I don't know what to do. And I become so overwhelmed that I kind of like, like, I don't know what to do. And I may overreact in a way or act in a way that is not, because when you are vulnerable, you're in a very raw state. So if I'm giving you something beautiful, you are totally empowered. But if you are raw, open, and I don't know how to deal with that, I can like harm you a lot without wanting to do that. That's my point. So if I don't know what to do with your vulnerability, I may end up trampling on your vulnerability, even if that was not my intention. It's just I didn't know what to do. Follow my point? So in that one example, no? So the intention was not there, but the skill was not there. or maybe skill, the wholeness was not there. The integration was not there. So I will say that it's important that, yeah, I remember when I visited, it was this year, yeah, also, I visited Richard Rohr, Franciscan monk. He lives in New Mexico. So I was invited to, I mean, I invited myself. I was invited the previous year, but he opened the door for me to visit him more than once. So I asked him and I visited him. And they were having a retreat of leadership among the members of their community. They were really, that was an interesting, serious consideration of how every single, of course, in their tradition, they may say priest or leader, has a psycho-emotional training to deal with people. No? Not only have their own issues are relatively healed on a personal level, but also you have some training in understanding and dealing with what people are going through nowadays in terms of emotions and psychology. Because if you are not like aligned with that in the name of giving advice, sometimes it may have good intention. It may provide something that is not helping, and that even can be a quote unquote well-intended abuse. And sometimes, again, in some cases, and I've seen that also, in some cases we see, unfortunately, some practitioners serving in the role of gurus with some unresolved issues that need to be really resolved, because sometimes those unresolved issues are passed down to the disciple and they are not recognized for what they are, unresolved issues. And instead, maybe a naive disciple will over-idealize that and think, wow, this is divine revelation coming from Gurudev. And it's no, it's unresolved trauma. And you are receiving unresolved trauma, which will become now part of your own trauma, but you are seeing that as divine revelation. So it becomes more tricky because it seems one thing, but it's something else. It can happen. It shouldn't ideally happen, but sometimes it happens, my friends.
generational trauma is thrown around a lot.
For example, yeah, that's a classical example, something that is certain. I was talking, I remember, with a friend of mine in the United States. He's a second generation devotee, and he will tell me, again, very lovingly, but I many times my parents, he will tell me, are passing down on me their own generational trauma. And I'm like, he told me, hey, I have my own generational trauma to deal with, no? So you have to solve that one yourself, right? Again, it's not they are doing that on purpose, consciously, but it's happening because maybe they themselves, his parents, are not seeing that as unresolved trauma. So they are trying to pass what they may even consider, this is the best I have to give you. No? Or maybe their child will say, hey, dad, that's unresolved generational trauma, which may be part of the child-father dynamics. No? The father starts to help dad to realize, oh, thank you. No, I have to work on this. Because if not, we create a parallel parampara, so to say. Instead of passing divine revelation and healed stuff, we are passing unresolved stuff. So in one sense, I will say, and I mentioned in the book, I don't know, if I'm a teacher, and I'm trying to pass down something to the next generation, and if I have some unresolved trauma, I should try to resolve my trauma, to use the example of the trauma, and to pass resolved trauma to other people. The example and the struggle of that, even if first is unresolved, and even if a disciple is pointing to the guru, not like pointing, hey, Gurudev, you have unresolved trauma. But sometimes that may happen, who knows? And if the guru is genuine, guru say, oh, thank you. So I will work on this. And then now I'm giving you the result of the resolved stuff. And the disciple will say, wow, thank you. I need to see elders working through their own stuff also. That's a necessary reference point of view. Like even acknowledging mistakes. You know, sometimes we, there are so many directions we can go, but sometimes we over absolutize the position of the guru to the point that the guru cannot make any mistake of any type, not even the mild mistake, as we were saying the other day. And if Gurudev mispronounces a word, then the dictionary has to be changed, right? And that's like, you are a fanatic. That's not strong faith. You are becoming dangerous by thinking like that. So sometimes we will think, okay, Gurudev does some mistakes. Sometimes in some even cases, at least I have some experience of that, some once guru may engage in something that is not a mild mistake, which is more delicate. And there is even some reference in Shastra. We were talking the other day about that with someone. I think it was Krishna Murari. For example, Krishna Bhajanamritam of Narahari Sarkartaka, he says, if your guru is deviating from the norm and doing something that it shouldn't be happening, the disciple can go to the guru and tell Gurudev, this is not what you taught me. This is not your being deviated, but in service to the guru. He says, the disciple shouldn't reject the guru. You are deviated. Who are you? In a loving way, like, Gurudev, you taught me so much. I'm so in depth that this is not correct. Please go back to the right path. Imploring, and I'm here to support you and continue the journey together and learning in that spirit. Of course, he says if the guru is blind, like the three monkeys, like blind, doesn't want to learn anything, one may need eventually to take distance. But the point is that it can happen. And if a guru commits a mistake, I think it's healthy to, how to say, that a guru also publicly acknowledges those mistakes. That can be a very healing experience for the community, right? When you have like an elder holding himself or herself accountable for something in a humble way, with sincerity, with willingness to change. I mean, everyone, I will say, will be inspired by that. It's not like, oh, let's leave this guy because he's not absolutely perfect. Oh, if you are sincere as a student, we will be moved by that. Like, wow. I'm having elders who are showing me the way because I'm full of mistakes. So I need to see how to deal with my own imperfections. Because sometimes we over-absolutize the guru to the point that it becomes discouraging to our faith. All the gurus are so perfect that I have no reference point of view to see an example for my own journey. Sometimes I've heard about saying that all gurus are Nitya Siddhas coming from Golok Vrindavan. To begin with, where do you get that reference? There's no. And second, how can you prove that? You have some like Nitya Siddha sensor or something, like you can Nitya Siddha or like measuring. It's not possible. Of course, if you want to think of your guru of someone as a Nitya Siddha, eternally liberated, that's fine. I have nothing against that. But if we overemphasize that, the point is that then every guru is already perfect from day one. So I don't find anyone that is showing me how to go through all the things that I'm going through. You follow my point? Because all of them were perfect always. So, and sometimes we try to make that emphasis. No, everyone has to be shown as perfect to protect the faith of the people. But for me, that's actually discouraging the faith of the people, because part of what my faith needs is to see some role model that is going through all the different chapters of the journey that I'm going through. But if they tell me all of them are perfect forever, it's like, okay, no point of reference, no point of reference, no point of reference. And okay, so you follow my point? So it can be discouraging without bad intention, but it can be discouraging. So, and with this, I'm not saying there are no gurus who are Nitya-siddha or there are no gurus who are absolutely advanced. There are different degrees of gurus and teachers. And in my opinion, it's healthy to normalize that and not having it to like force everyone is perfect, everyone is absolute, because when some problem comes, then that over-absolutization creates full collapse. And that happens so many times also.
So do you think that, for example, when devotees are in general, devotees do that, do you think they feel so much pressure themselves? Because, I mean, living with that idea that everyone sees me as perfect must be such a burden
for
them.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for making that point that I also want to make, that because maybe, and even we don't need to even talk about gurus. Sometimes we're just talking about, I don't know, sannyasi or a temple president or a local leader, and sometimes we get this idea of, okay, you have to be perfect for the community. You need to nourish faith, so you have to be example. And that creates like a superficial, like superhero template. Like, have to be, and I have my problems, but nobody can see them, right? Like I was talking, I think it was Ananda Murari when he was sharing some dynamics that I think it was Hamsa Dutta had at his time, some problems he had. We have problems. I'm not criticizing him, I'm just normalizing. We have problems. Of course, he was guru at that time, and we know that at that time, maybe some of the gurus were a little bit over idealized without bad intention. Again, it's not here to, okay, who's to blame here? It happened like that. And that I think it was Krishnamurti, he went to some of even of his disciples telling them, hey, guys, I'm having some problem with drinking. But the disciples had already such an over-idealized idea of him that they were like, Jai Gurudev is like Nityananda and Abadut, and he's drunk, and this is a new Leela that he's performing. And it's like, oops.
That's the reason why Kridananda Maharaj is advising everyone to see Life of Brian, a movie.
Okay.
Python, and they are also completely crazy because of worship.
Oh, I see. No one can. Okay. And then the problem is that then he went from his disciples, which I appreciate, approaching your own students to share your heart with them in that situation is a very courageous step, honest. But he found that particular feedback, which was not, and he insisted, no, it's not that. But they were like, yeah, you are perfect, everything is Leela, Kijai, Kijai. So also that's part of the responsibility of a disciple, right? From which place am I want to, do I really want to relate to my guru, which just I need some overly perfect figure so I don't have to do my own thing because he's so perfect? Anyhow, whole conversation. And then he went to some of his god brothers. He went from the juniors to the peers and like, I'm having this problem. Okay, but you cannot tell anything because the whole thing collapses. So you just keep being perfect, Again, I'm not saying there was bad intention. I'm not saying that to criticize. It's just at that time, maybe that was the way the bots were thinking how to keep the thing together. And it makes sense. Things were collapsing on some level, how to keep the thing together. We are trying as best as we can with our maturity at the time, with the tools at the time, and we can learn from all that and be grateful as well. But yeah, it's related to what you are mentioning, because okay, so I'm receiving that feedback, so I'm supposed to be perfect, I'm supposed to not show ups and downs, I have no problems, I'm transcendental, so you are inspired with me. But it's like a time bomb, right? It's so much repression. It's like if you have a hose, the water is coming, and I like close the hose, and the water starts to accumulate. No? And I'm just closed, not open. And at one point, it will be like, just a matter of time. So it's not natural. So I think it's also healthy that the group, in order to avoid those things, we gradually normalize imperfection, basically. Normalize struggle, normalize the journey, the stages of the journey in a way that, yeah, and normalize for people, hey, it's not that everything has to be perfect and everything has, no, also allow imperfection to be part of your journey. Learn to integrate imperfection. Because if not, we are not training people to offer unconditional love. We are just training people to offer conditional love. You only love because he's perfect. You are my Gurudev, I give you myself completely because you are perfect, of course. The very moment you show that you are imperfect, everything collapses. So that shows what? I'm not willing to give unconditional love. Unconditional means it doesn't matter the condition. Of course, by this, I'm not saying allow yourself to be abused or something like that, but there has to be some unconditionality in our giving to someone else. It's not just, only if you are perfect, I love you. Well, that's not how Krishna is loving us. Krishna is not sending us a message. Tell me when you reach perfection and then I care for you. He's already doing that with us being a mess. So we are expected to extend something similar. So yeah, I think it's important to both from both sides to normalize some of these landscapes of the spiritual journey, which may include some, not to normalize abuse or anything like that, but also to be more human and realistic. That doesn't necessarily mean that every guru, sannyasi, temple president, leader is like an absolutely enlightened Mahabhagavat coming from the highest peaks of whatever. I think it's more sustainable. And of course, I feel that after so many years in general, I'm talking about the community in general, different missions, Gaudiya Sampradaya, other traditions, people gradually normalizes the things, integrates, matures, learn from experience. Still, there may be a way to go for that, but I had some other themes in mind, but I don't want to overextend. And also, I'd like to open, if you have questions, or I mean, you already are sharing some questions or thoughts or topics, because I have another call at 8. So I need to, we have time still, but also I'd like to open if you have any thoughts or things you may like to share in this connection. As you can see today, we're exploring more the certain aspects of the relationship that sometimes are not the usual, like discourse on guru and disciple, which is incredible in its own way. I have nothing against that, just in a compliment, in service to that, trying to go to some of these nuances and possibilities. Yes, Dinadaya.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I think it's very relevant. And just by listening, so many things come to my mind. Because personally, I'm also part of this ISKCON Disciple course. Sometimes this number of people are coming looking to get the certificate and move forward in accepting the guru. So all those things you are speaking about, and you can read how new people are thinking about. I'm just speaking on the level of ISKCON society. Since Prabhupada left till now, only maybe 10 years ago, they started to at least educate new people into the guru tattva in a systematic way, which is to a degree healthy. I also realized how it was before, completely messed. They idealized people or person, and there is no normality in that relationship. I would say, as we are speaking about that more and kind of coming in front of our eyes, things are better and better, and I like you said, normalized. Things are much kind of realistic, and it's kind of very grounding and sobering. Thank you on that, and kind of to say much more about it, I don't know what that means. I have quite a number of comments which are kind of connected to that.
We are all learning from experience. I myself had to go through my own chapters to come after that. And okay, there's some lessons, some life lessons, some scars as well, some scars and some scars, both. But yeah, it's all meant to teach us. And sometimes what I felt is, of course, guru, disciple is the most beautiful, in one sense, relationship, potentially something incredible. But if some things are not in place, the most beautiful thing can end up being one of the most traumatic experiences for some people. So for me, that's the point. Now, something has the potential of being so sheltering and inspiring and beautiful, but we have to know how to handle that in a way that is really taking us there for both. Again, not only for the disciple, because as we say, for the guru also can be a complicated situation. Imagine, I don't know, having people over-idealizing you on a daily basis, thousands and thousands. If they are not somehow educated not to do that, and at the beginning it may not be possible to do that, because in the beginning just a neophyte disciple just over-idealizes. You cannot help but that. And it's okay. You cannot stop doing that. Like a child will think, my dad is God, basically. Literally, there is some research done with children that they were asking, you know, they were playing a game and they will ask to the child, he was, I don't know, 4 years, so who makes the rules of this game? And they were like, my dad. Huh? So they have this kind of over-absolutization. And who did that? My dad. Huh? So he's kind of the creator of the universe, so to say. Yeah, literally. Literally, they think like that. So somehow some of those patterns, and of course the dad has to be sober enough to realize that he's not God. No? But he cannot avoid his child thinking like that. He has 4 years old. It's okay. In a few years, he will think differently, hopefully. And he has to do something for that to happen. So in the same way, a guru, okay, it has to have some capacity of dealing with the over-idealization with the neophyte disciples, but also carry them in a way that that takes some maturity and the relationship happens from other place eventually. Because if it's an overdose of kijais, as I like to say sometimes, that can be overwhelming for the guru also. How much capacity do you have to deal with that? Having thousands per day or hundreds or even one sometimes. You don't need thousands, just one person telling you, it can be too much. No? So as I mentioned, I like to say over-idealization, any form of over-idealization takes to dehumanization. If I'm over-idealizing you, I'm dehumanizing you. If I'm making you less from what you are, I'm dehumanizing you. If I'm making you more of what you are, it's basically the same in the other direction. Although externally it seems praise. I'm over-idealizing you, I'm over-praised, I'm dehumanizing you. Without intention, but that's what's happening. So Srila Prabhupada saying one comment, when someone is praised for things that they are not praiseworthy and it's overpraised, that actually constitutes an insult, he say, to the person. Again, without intention, but it's not actual praise. So yeah, in one sense, we could say we can never glorify the guru enough, but at the same time, you can over-glorify the guru. You follow my point? In one sense, as a child, you can never glorify your father enough, but you can over-glorify your father. Say, my father is more than God. That's too much. But you can glorify your guru accurately in certain parameter, unlimitedly. But you can also go beyond those parameters, and that's not legal. That's not tasteful. That's rasa bhas. So you can do also that with the guru. So we have to find the parameter where we can feel, I can glorify my Gurudev forever, endlessly, properly, but not over-glorify, because that, as Prabhupada said, that's more an insult than praise or things like this. Right? Yes, Ramhari.
I have a question. When you said that you can, when Dr. Guru, you can get, you think it's a revelation, but it's trauma, right? Mm. Remember when you were in trauma. I was curious if you can maybe give an example, like, from just like a more frequent cases that happen. I would be curious to see how that might look like, or what you probably had something in mind. Yeah.
Lots. Unfortunately, I have lots of references coming in this precise moment. I'm now scanning and selecting.
Couple.
The less bizarre several ones. I don't want to leave all
the best. The best of
them. On the top five, the top three shocking statements.
It's weekend, so we can
click.
We deserve.
I mean, overindulge on a Saturday. Again, it's we are laughing not to cry, probably, no? Because also there are delicate topics, right? It's not that we want to turn this into a gossip and laugh about anything, because this is mostly tragedy and trauma for many, and many of us present here probably may have been through something of that on one degree or another. I don't know. I just talk for me.
Sometimes it's funny because it's true.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. One example. And I, of course, I won't go into names and specifics of the situation, but just guru becoming a sexual predator. And the disciple, the young lady disciple, thinking, oh, Gurudev is giving me the grace of rendering him intimate service. And as Krishna has intimate connection with the gopis, here I'm offering, and I have the chance of offering Madhurya Seva, romantic relief or whatever, assistance to my Gurudev. I've heard that more than once. Of course, that speaks about some unresolved stuff from both sides. No? Because for you to conclude like that as a disciple, where are you? No? For a guru to become a sexual predator and serial sexual predator, there's some unresolved stuff, for sure. There's some unresolved trauma. No? Or, I don't know, a guru having been as a child very rejected by his parents, and developing low self-esteem, and in the low self-esteem shows itself in the form of not being able when some disciple develops some but maybe it's not so much taken as a revelation. Let me think about that. Okay. So someone has very low self-esteem because of being totally rejected. And again, we should see all this with compassion also. We are not pointing to people. They are so evil, and there has to be seen with compassion. So they are not capable of listening to anyone else, or they are not capable of acknowledging their own mistakes, because they have such a poor self-image that if they are to open and acknowledge their mistakes, their already poor self-image shatters completely. But externally, it will sound like, oh, Gurudev is so fixed and so determined and so in, I don't know. So how you, anyhow, we can create so many words. But it says, actually what's going on is that person is completely closed to receive feedback and open. But you can see that as he has very strong character, very determined and very powerful, and he knows what he's doing. You follow my point? And you translate it as that in your naive disciple perspective. But actually, maybe that person has a very poor self-image and is not open to receive any feedback, because that threatens his own sense of self. Another example coming more from there. You still want the top three?
Yes. I could go for another one.
Oh my gosh.
But not more. I know if it's on the spot.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah.
That's enough. There are many more, more than 3 and 10 and 100 and 8 and so on. But yeah, I think it's clear. The point is clear.
Some people they perform in the role of guru, but they have issues with anger. And really, they're kind of becoming mad, especially if they have someone who is subordinate. So that trigger is very much with them. I don't know how it goes from psychological level. And then it's perceived by younger people as kind of, oh, he's so... giving mercy. He's giving mercy because he's abusing others and kind of making them, fool them around. Literally, I saw in my eyes, fool them literally.
Like humiliation.
It's a spiritual education, so it's transcendental. So I would say that's very relevant. It goes constantly.
Yeah.
And they call it drilling. It took 10 to 30 years ago as a kind of this education.
He's strict. The word strict is very problematic. We used it a lot. he's very strict. What does it mean?
Was no. this on number one? Is yeah. that example, or are you put me on the next?
No, no, no.
This
is a perfect one.
What happens?
Yeah, sometimes you can say, "Even sorry, these things happen." Oh, you are being tested.
Mm. Yeah.
No? So everything is like a controlled experiment. No?
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
to say, no, like the guru is always in control and he's always aware of what's going on. So it's all under control, and you're just being tested, and your loyalty is being. Sometimes this narrative enters, and the problem is that enters and it applies to everything and to anything, right? So, and one more thing, and I pass you the mic. But the problem is also sometimes you have, and that's another department, but you have the disciples who are codependent, and you have a guru who is a narcissist. That's the perfect fit. A narcissist leader, codependent student. That connects like magic. And they will feel like ecstatic about that. They will feel like this is everything. But it's absolute spiritual bypassing and evasiveness and self-cheating. And that can last for years. And it's like a romance and an eternal honeymoon. But there is, that's a clinical case. And there are many studies. I've been studying some psychological books of narcissism on leaders. This book that I told you I'm reading now, the shadow on the spiritual path, and there's lots of things to discern. No, sorry.
So I was thinking that many times, what happens is like, for example, someone has a terrible like. You know, couple life, and they say, "No, I'm going to take some yes."
Mm-hmm.
And then, what you were saying about like, because you can have like three pillars: a spiritual intelligence and like emotional, you know, intelligence. Sometimes, you say, oh, but he's so learned, you know, he's just ready to be a guru. But maybe, you know, what he went through is whatever, and then he's just like, you know, like this married life, this, you know. The dark world. I hear that in classes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and then you just scratch a little bit, and it seems that the person had a terrible.
Yeah, they are projecting their own unresolved stuff or their own frustration on their own personal life, and like, if I was miserable, you will have to be miserable. No, so I had a bad experience with this. So if you are going through the marriage as I was miserable. You all are miserable. No? That's just pure. Projection and not taking personal responsibility ultimately. So, yeah. So many things. I mean, we can remain talking for a long time, but I think it's healthy to name the things again, not with anger and resentment and who is to blame, but just naming and framing. Because if you don't have a word for that, it doesn't exist in one sense. If you are not naming and being giving yourself permission to talk about things, it remains. Kind of invisible and remains hidden. So just bringing it to awareness in a healthy spirit, again, with compassion, with understanding, with gratitude, with not like full of resentment and hate, that's needed for healing. Whatever needs to be healed for needs to be acknowledged. Whatever unhealed, unredeemed parts in us, disowned parts in us, they need first to be acknowledged, named, framed, addressed, healed. Here I have one question from Yamuna Dev from UK. Maybe I address this briefly and maybe we close today. She's, and I know her, of course, and I know from which place she's asking. Aren't you supposed to worship the guru as good as God? So what to say about that? Of course, again, it comes to the point that I also mentioned in my book, because the scriptures say, when they speak about the guru, say, you have to surrender completely and give everything. But the point is, what the scriptures have in mind when they use the word guru? When the scriptures say guru and invite for full surrender, they are talking about the fully qualified person being guru. They are not talking about someone who is, I don't know, dysfunctional or has some problems that may end up in abuse. When the Shastra says guru, Shastra says about the things about the ideal representation of that. Like when you think about, I don't know, you go to an encyclopedia and look for an apple, they will describe you a fully perfect, healthy apple. the implications that they won't talk about the rotten apple, right? That would be a separate category, rotten. What it means rotten. Okay, then can be a rotten apple. But you go to apple, apple is red, it's round, it's nice, sweet, right? No worms inside. That's an apple. So the same way when Shastra says guru, it assumes that the person performing the role is perfect. So then you have to think for yourself, when someone is not doing that, I cannot apply the absolute statements of Shastra in that same degree to that same person, because that will open the doors for abuse. You follow? Someone is serving as guru, having some problems and dysfunctionality, starts to mistreat people, abuse, and you're like, no, but this guru is no different from Krishna, it's absolute. And then you are opening doors for a cult, basically. All is Leela. No, all is mercy. And it's like, wait a minute, but this is guru, is guru. No, in that moment, that person is not representing guru. No. That you are serving in that role doesn't mean that you're representing that department. Remember, we were talking today, you have the agency of Guru Tattva and you have the agent that represents the agency. As much as an agent, you are representing the agency, you are trustworthy. When you are betraying the agency, you are no longer representing that. Like if I'm a policeman, well, here in Belgium, you told me policemen are trustworthy, right? So we can give the example here. If I will be in any other country, probably that's not a fit example.
Because
Italy, Argentina, you see a policeman and you just get nervous and scared and run in the other direction. But here you will feel, okay, this person is protecting, is a well-wisher, protecting the law. Because the policeman is representing the police department, right? So the agent is representing the agency. But as long as the policeman is going against the agency, you cannot take that person as a policeman. You follow my point? So it's the same guru as an individual representing the guru agency. So when scriptures worship the guru as good as God, basically, the idea is not even worship the guru as good as God. The guru is more to be followed, not so much to be worshipped. Like Christ also in the Bible. In the Bible, you don't find Jesus saying, worship me. He says, follow me. But generally, it's easier to worship someone than follow someone. I put you a garland on a big seat, over-idealizing you, so I don't have to follow you. Oof, that's another. But that's what you are supposed to do. Sometimes we end up worshiping and over-idealizing, so we don't have actually to become that person in terms of following the example. So, and again, as good as God means if genuine guru is representing God's will, a genuine guru. So if that's going on, you are invited to, not forced, but invited to give yourself to that, because that's giving itself to you. It's a reciprocal giving of the self. It's not just you, disciple, give yourself to the guru. No. First, the guru has to be giving himself, herself fully. And naturally, that will invite for the giving of the disciple. The guru should not even demand from anyone, hey, you have to surrender to me. You have to give yourself to me. What's going on? You're not giving yourself to me. That's not how it happens. It's the guru is giving his heart so completely. Like I've talked with so many disciples of Prabhupada that they felt, oh, he's giving to us so much, giving so much. That we just naturally, it was not a thinking thing. It's just I want to give my life to that person. So that's how it has to happen ideally, not like. So yeah, I hope that helps, Jamuna. Thanks for the question. So yeah, we can continue, but as I told you, in a few minutes I have another lecture, the third one of the day. I had the one before this one. I don't want to play the victim. I chose that and take full responsibility, but I need a few minutes to reboot the system. So tomorrow we have one more gathering. At the same time, I will be open for questions and answers of any direction. So even if there were some pending questions today or comments, we can continue sharing tomorrow. So Thank you so much, Sri Sri Guru Sishya Parampara Ki Jai, Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Chila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Krishna Balaram Ki Jai, Sadhu Sangha Ki Jai, Bodh Pramananda, Panchakalpataru Vistakti Prasindhu Pyevu Chapati Thanam Pavane Pyo Vaishnave Pyo Namo Namo Ananta Koti Vaishnava Brinda Ki Jai, Bodh Pramananda, Hari Bodh. Yes.